The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is again dated August 18, 2025. Bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering from an off-white to a gradation of light gray because the background upon which it is superimposed is in tones of ivory to beige to a tan color. The photograph on the cover is that of Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House. He's dressed in a dark suit, white shirt, and dark tie. He wears glasses. He's looking not at the camera. His hair is neatly trimmed. It's salt and pepper, I would say, gray and darker tones. The first article, The Rise of Green Wall Street. Cities are racing to become the world's sustainable finance hub, by Justin Warland, London. This may be abridged. It's not real long, but it's moderately long. The Great Hall in the City of London's Guildhall might seem like an odd place to anchor a climate summit at a time when leading climate thinkers are increasingly calling for systemic change. It screams tradition. Built in 1411, the medieval auditorium is an homage to age-old British institutions and customs, with stained glass windows honoring lord mayors and monarchs. The dissonance is only amplified by its surroundings, a square mile housing the world's leading financial institutions. Gleaming towers of banks and investment firms with proprietors historically far more focused on adding up their financial returns than on calculating progress toward net zero emissions. And yet Guildhall and the city, with a capital C, as the financial district is known, were the center of action in June when 45,000 climate advocates from around the world descended on London for its annual Climate Action Week. To participate, attendees hopped between meetings at Guildhall, the London Stock Exchange, and myriad banks, insurers, and other financial institutions found in the area. The location was no coincidence. To tackle climate change will require moving immense sums of money, and the institutions located in the City of London have money to lend and invest. But the decision was not entirely or even primarily altruistic. Positioning London as the key node in the world of sustainable finance could pay off big as the sector continues to grow. A boom in jobs and wealth will be bestowed wherever banks and financial institutions focused on this issue set up shop. Estimates on the size of the opportunity vary depending on methodology, but most research suggests by the 2030s, the values of sustainable finance will reach double-digit trillions. What we've got here is an economic growth story of the 21st century, says Alok Sharma, the former British cabinet minister who served as president of the 2021 UN Climate Conference in Glasgow. This is not just about climate. Sharma, whose soft-spoken disposition belies his convening power in the climate space, is now charged with the important task of wrangling the financial sector, government, and industry to chart a path forward for the country as chair of the Transition Finance Council. The council, launched by the British government and the City of London, is working through how to leverage the city's deep capital markets and history of financial innovation to make the city and the country the world's green finance leader. We have a financial ecosystem in London, which very few markets can rival, he notes. London has succeeded in taking pole position, but it is far from the only place that has caught on. Across the globe, financial hubs, largely in Europe and Asia, have launched efforts to attract the growing sustainable finance industry. Leaning into their global connections and deep capital markets, Abu Dhabi and Singapore have emerged as leading contenders, giving London a run for its money. In many ways, the effort in these three cities and around the world is collaborative. Growth in the sector will lift all boats, but it's also fiercely competitive. The city or cities that win will not only bring jobs and wealth, but also give victors outsized influence, shaping the future of both the global financial system and the fight against climate change. Walking through the City of London today can feel a bit like tracing the history of global finance. The modern Bank of England, a cornerstone of the country's financial might, sits only a short stroll from its original 1694 location. The age-old cemetery, sprinkled between today's glass office buildings, serves as the final resting place for some of London's original financiers. And in some cases, even the odd-sounding streets tie back to the city's financial roots. Lombard Street, named for the Italian region, known for its bankers and merchants, or Ironmonger Lane, which once housed the metal trading houses. At its core, London's sustainable finance opportunity is part and parcel with this history. In today's parlance, innovation tends to refer to technological innovation, but many of the biggest breakthroughs to emerge from London over the centuries were financial. From the launch of the world's first joint stock companies in the 16th century, which pioneered risk sharing among investors and created some of the world's first tradable securities, to pioneering of the modern insurance market in the 17th century by Lloyd's of London. In short, over some 500 years, British financiers built the foundations of today's global financial system. Now, these foundations need some climate-minded reinvention, and at lightning speed. The International Energy Agency estimates investment in clean energy must reach $4.5 trillion annually in the 2030s to meet climate goals. To get that money to the global south where it's most needed will require new financial structures that make investing less risky. In some corners of the globe, most importantly the U.S., the push to tweak the rules of the road has been met with soft denial. The federal government has halted efforts to think through the financial disclosure of climate risk and exited cooperative efforts with other countries aimed at greening the financial system. In London, leaders in both government and the private sector are jumping on the opportunity. Britain is open for business, says Sharma. We are a very established market, but you cannot sort of sit there and rest on your laurels. Even for a close watcher of the climate finance space, it can be difficult to keep track of everything coming out of London. Under both of the country's major parties in recent years, the British government has launched a flurry of efforts to help its financial services industry lead the global sustainable finance movement. The Financial Conduct Authority has worked on greenwashing regulations and the standards for applying a sustainable label to products. The Green Finance Institute was created in 2019 to coordinate public-private efforts. In 2021, the Treasury launched green bonds sales to demonstrate government commitment to the sector. And last year, the current government created a national wealth fund to invest in a range of low-carbon technologies, attracting private finance in the process. Since launching earlier this year, Sharma's Transition Finance Council has quickly become an essential node. The group focuses specifically on transition finance, the branch of sustainable finance where money is invested not only to build clean technologies, but also to decarbonize big sources of emissions. Think of lending to an oil company to fix leaks in its pipes to stop methane from seeping out, or putting up the money for a steel producer to convert to a less emissions-intensive process. In other mainstream approaches, green technology or ESG-related investing that tries to identify and protect against environmental risks is prioritized. In transition finance, you can run to the problem and spend money trying to fix it, even if that means financing a dirty industry for a short while. In some jurisdictions, transition finance is a thorny subject because it means dealing with polluting industries, but it's a big opportunity, both for the financial sector and the planet. The World Economic Forum estimates transition finance for carbon-heavy sectors, including aviation, shipping, and steel production, represents a $13.5 trillion opportunity in the coming decades. These so-called hard-to-abate sectors make up 40% of global emissions today. The Transition Finance Council sounds wonky, and it is. The body of government officials, investors, and top executives in industry and finance was formed to work through the technicalities of key issues hand in hand with the private sector. One subcommittee tackles credibility and integrity. Another works on pathways, policies, and governance. The Transition Finance Market Review report, released last year, ahead of the group's launch, explores how firms navigate credible third-party standards and carbon budget delivery plans. Splashy, public-facing marketing campaign this is not. Yet, this is the sort of work needed to give firms the confidence to set up their transition finance shop in London. It is hard to find an economic growth story as revered as Singapore's. The country transformed from a low-income nation into a financial powerhouse in just a few generations, driven in large part by deliberate investments and a thoughtful approach to economic policymaking. Today, Singapore's placing a long-term bet on climate and hoping it can own the future of sustainable finance in Asia. The timeline is not set by business cycles. It is not set by the electoral cycle, says Ravi Menon, Singapore's climate ambassador, at a June event in London. The planet's timeline will eventually impose its will on us, and when it does, Singapore wants to be prepared. More than 3,000 miles away from London, Abu Dhabi has its own global network, forged through its position selling vast quantities of oil to the rest of the world. For that very reason, a cynical climate advocate might look at the city's push into sustainable finance with deep skepticism. Drive across the capital of the United Arab Emirates, and you will see nonstop reminders that this is oil and gas country. From the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company logo affixed on prominent skyscrapers to the network of fossil fuel infrastructure just off the coastline. But also prominently fixed in the city's skyline are the sleek buildings that host the money managers overseeing more than $1 trillion in capital. The funds may have come from selling oil to the world, but leaders in the Emirates know sooner or later they will need to diversify, and attracting sustainable finance is a key part of their agenda. In the spring of 2023, as the UAE was in the midst of developing Altera and Singapore was crafting its taxonomy for Asia, the U.S. was immersed in a fight over whether fund managers can legally take climate change into account in their decision-making. Then and now, the mainstream U.S. conversation at the intersection of climate and finance is vastly different from the same conversations happening around the world. As other countries innovate, the U.S. government is at best caught in a defensive posture and at worst pulling back. During the Biden years, the Federal Reserve dipped its toes into the network for greening the financial system before promptly pulling out after Donald Trump's election. And the U.S. federal government has abandoned any efforts to craft financial disclosure rules around climate. To be clear, big U.S. financial firms with operations outside the U.S. will need to comply with this growing segment of climate regulation. The rules will just be drafted somewhere else. It may not worry Wall Street just yet. While cities like London and Singapore have developed global finance hubs, today there's no question the U.S. is the epicenter. The country has the deepest capital markets in the world's reserve currency. It houses the biggest and most influential global financial firms. Yet, as sustainable finance grows, its influence has the potential to eat away at the U.S. position. That road will be long and windy as every place faces its own unique challenges. In the UK, politicians need to explain to voters why the government is spending so much time on sustainable finance in the midst of other challenges. Indeed, some efforts to bolster sustainable finance have stalled or been dropped entirely. Presumably with those political questions in mind, in Abu Dhabi, leaders must confront the skepticism in many corners about the ability of a big oil-producing country to deliver on climate, and Singapore faces the consistent challenge that comes from existing in the shadow of China, which also has designs on developing a sustainable finance sector. Those questions will eventually be resolved, and a new paradigm will emerge. The winners will not just capture economic opportunity. They will help determine whether the world has the financial infrastructure to avoid the worst effects of climate change. This article, again, The Rise of Green Wall Street, written by Justin Warland, London, was somewhat abridged. This article is headlined World, entitled The Nationalist. Giorgia Meloni is the first far-right Italian leader since World War II. Where She Takes the Country Could Change the World, by Massimo Calabresi, Rome. I shall also abridge this lengthy article. It is late afternoon, July 4, in Rome's Palazzo Chigi, seat of the Italian government, and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is walking the marble-floored halls. She spent the past hour answering questions about her personal history, rise to power, record in office with disarming directness. But now, as the interview winds down, she has a question of her own. "You are an honest person," she begins in the crisp English she says she learned from Michael Jackson's songs. "Is there something about fascism that my experience reminds you of, about what I'm doing in government?" Fascism is a subject Meloni cannot escape. When she came to power in October 2022, atop a movement founded by Benito Mussolini's last devoted followers, critics in Italy and across Europe said her calls for national pride and the defense of Western civilization portended a far-right turn for the world's eighth largest economy. President Joe Biden cited her election as an example of the threat authoritarianism poses to global democracy. But Meloni has confounded her critics. At home, she's tacked to the center on some of her more dramatic campaign promises, like imposing a naval blockade to stop shipborne illegal immigrants. On the international stage, she has behaved less like a right-wing revolutionary than a pragmatic conservative. Meloni's embraced the European Union, NATO, and Ukraine, worked to isolate China, and labored deftly to reconcile the fractious relationships between America and Europe during the start of President Donald Trump's second term. Along the way, she's won over leaders from across the ideological spectrum, from Biden to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to Vice President J.D. Vance. Nearly 3 years into her term, Meloni, 48, has emerged as one of Europe's most interesting figures. A 5'2" working-class unmarried mother without a college degree, whose rise has defied the expectations of her peers. She opposes what she calls homogenizing globalism, yet champions European integration. She is the first female leader of Italy and says that in her career she's had to confront ridiculous stereotypes, but rejects government attempts to fix that or other forms of discrimination, which she labels quotas. She claims conservative victories in stabilizing Italy's famously chaotic government and improving its debt rating, while also pursuing a policy agenda in step with the global cadre of rising authoritarian leaders, consolidating executive power, cracking down on the media, exerting control over the judiciary, targeting undocumented immigrants, and limiting some forms of protest. From all these contradictions, Meloni is constructing a new kind of nationalism, populist, nativist, pro-Western, but committed to European and Atlantic alliances. First of all, we have to defend what we are, our culture, our identity, our civilization, she says, sitting with arms and legs crossed in front of an Italian flag. Where exactly that leads matters beyond Italy. From Portugal to Romania, once ostracized extremists on the far right are overtaking traditional conservative parties, much like the MAGA movement in the U.S. That has presented a crisis for centrist European governments whose populations for decades after World War II shunned far-right parties. It is a quirk of history, Meloni's fashioning a 21st century nationalism in the country that embodied the liberalizing 19th century version through its unification, and in Mussolini created the catastrophic fascist model in the 20th. Meloni has repeatedly rejected the latter, but she embraces the former in almost irredentist terms, declaring her intention to rebuild our identity, rebuild pride, the pride of being who we are, whatever it takes. Because Italy is one of the world's wealthiest countries and is a founding member of the European Union. The nationalism she unleashes stands to influence where Western democracy heads next. Meloni's abilities were evident in mid-April when she arrived in Washington for her ritual turn in the Oval Office hot seat, During Trump's first 6 months in office, he has sought to demonstrate his alpha status by inviting foreign leaders into the West Wing, then bringing in the press for extended performances of domination. Visitors who fail to perform the requisite display of obeisance have faced consequences, as in the February 28 blow-up with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. When Meloni arrived for her turn, she went the extra mile to avoid missteps. "I'm a Capricorn," she says, "so let's say I'm fixed on some things." She prepared a stack of cards with her positions on every issue that might come up and survived the public test with poise. Yet the telling moment came after the press left, when the topic turned to Ukraine's war with Russia. Meloni fiercely defended Zelensky and the need to support Ukraine to the end. Trump listened and responded, but without the exchange becoming contentious, Meloni says. "He's a fighter and I'm a fighter," she says. The episode stuck with Vance, who was in the meeting. "She's extraordinarily direct," Vance told NBC News, May 20. "She actually reminds me a little bit of Vance's wife, Usha, in that way, where she can deliver an extraordinarily direct message without coming across as offensive. That's just a skill, right?" Meloni's candor has long been one of her defining traits. "She's always been like this, since when she was a child," says her sister, Ariana, her closest advisor and now head of Brothers of Italy. Meloni's signature position has been to crack down on illegal immigration. The courts have blocked much of what she tried to do, including an expensive misadventure where she paid 67.5 million euros to build and maintain a facility in Albania at which to detain migrants, only to have it ruled a violation of law. Human rights advocates have found that undocumented immigrants who were intercepted and returned to Libya in a program championed by Meloni were in some cases tortured. In rhetoric and policy, she's created a hostile environment for migrants and refugees, says Judith Sunderland of Human Rights Watch. Meloni forged an alliance with von der Leyen, who leaned on Meloni to stabilize Europe's relations with Trump after his opening trade war salvos. The budding partnership has led to speculation that Meloni and her far-right allies may eventually usurp power from the more traditional conservative bloc in Brussels, just as she's united the center and far-right parties in Italy. Says La Repubblica's Molinari, "Her majority is the only example in Europe where all the different identities of the right sit together in a government. They do not fight. This is her political strength in European terms. She is in the middle." Meloni wants a system with stronger executive power, and she advocates for a democratic model that can accommodate parties on the far right instead of gatekeeping. Meloni says her critics have invoked her far-right background as a weapon against any policy she adopts. "They've been accusing me of every possible thing, from the war in Ukraine to the people dying in the Mediterranean. It is simply because they don't have arguments," she says. But the attacks bother her, and she comes back to them as she strolls through the Palazzo Chigi. "I am not a racist," she says. "I am not homophobic. I am not all the things they have been saying." But there are plenty of members of her party who still nurse a nostalgia for fascism. Second in line to the presidency behind Meloni, Ignazio La Russa once kept a bust of Mussolini in his apartment. Asked what kind of nationalism she espouses, Meloni says hers is mainly a way to defend ourselves from a globalization that did not work. A moment later, however, she admiringly quotes the 19th century French nationalist Ernest Renan, an influential anti-Semite. What is unsettling about Meloni is not so much her behavior as her accommodation of the forces that nationalism has unleashed in the past, at a moment when post-war norms are fading away. Even she seems to grasp this. Once again, after the interview, Meloni wonders how she appears to outsiders. "Are you sincerely concerned about something?" she asks. "That is my question." In Europe, where the ghosts of authoritarianism and its tens of millions of victims haunt every corner of the continent, it is hard not to be. World, again, headlines this article. Its viewpoint, titled "Stopping Starvation in Gaza," by David Miliband, who is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. July 29, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, the Global Gold Standard Initiative, charged with assessing hunger and food insecurity, released a devastating but predictable analysis, famine, the worst-case scenario humanitarian actors have been warning about for the past 21 months, is unfolding in Gaza. According to the IPC, a body that prides itself on technical expertise and is not given to hyperbole, two of the three thresholds required to classify famine in Gaza have been surpassed: food consumption and acute malnutrition have reached catastrophic levels. The third threshold, mortality from starvation and related causes, remains unverified. This is not because people are not dying. It's because the conditions on the ground, lack of humanitarian access, raging conflict, the collapse of the health system, make data collection very hard. Why wait for a postmortem when we can save these lives now? The IPC analysis is not a warning, it's a photograph, like those of the emaciated children that have shocked the world. I've heard it myself from International Rescue Committee, IRC staff in Gaza. We must believe our eyes and ears. This is happening now. The Israeli government's restrictions on aid have created the conditions for famine, and the window to prevent mass death is closing. This famine is a man-made catastrophe. It is a consequence not of natural scarcity, but of political choices. At the IRC, we already see the impact of inaction. One in five children in Gaza City is now acutely malnourished. Our Palestinian partners and IRC staff are delivering nutrition, child protection, and health and hygiene support under relentless pressure. The IRC knows all too well what severe acute malnutrition does to children's bodies. It destroys immunity, making common illnesses like diarrhea or pneumonia lethal. It halts brain development, impairs physical growth, leaves lifelong consequences. A child suffering from severe acute malnutrition is 12 times more likely to die from disease than a well-nourished child. Despite the overwhelming evidence of rampant malnutrition and growing deaths from starvation, Gaza remains all but sealed off. At the IRC, we have several tons of life-saving medical supplies ready and waiting to enter, enough to treat thousands and bolster a health system collapsing under the weight of war and deprivation. These supplies sit idle. Hospitals are either destroyed or overwhelmed. Fuel is scarce. Food prices have surged by 700%. Gaza's essential services have collapsed. Instead of opening land routes, the international community has turned to airdrops and maritime routes, stopgaps that, while well-intentioned, are no substitute for safe, sustained access. Airdrops are inefficient, dangerous, incapable of delivering the specialized food and medical care required to save malnourished children. Land routes are not only the most efficient option, they're the only realistic one at the scale and speed this crisis demands. The solution is tragically simple. First, open all viable land crossings, not with caveats, but at scale, to flood Gaza with aid immediately. During the ceasefire months of January and February this year, the flow of humanitarian and commercial goods made a difference immediately. Second, ensure unimpeded access for humanitarian organizations to reach children and their families from Rafah to northern Gaza. A ceasefire remains vital. Without an end to hostilities, no humanitarian corridor can function safely. Palestinian civilians cannot be reached at scale, and the hostages will not return home. This is not a crisis that demands more data. It demands more determination, not from those struggling to survive, but from national and international leadership that needs to speak out against the blockade that's driving people to more death. The world knows what's happening in Gaza. The cost of delay will be measured in the lives of children lost. It is too late for too many, but not for all. The choice is ours, and the time is now. On the same page comes this shorter column under the heading Health. This crisis will outlast the war, by Juwayraya Wright. For the past 8 of his 20 months of life, Enes Al-Wahidi's toddler son Taim has weighed the same, 9 kilograms, just short of 20 pounds. We do not have enough flour, so every day we make 3 pieces of bread, Al-Wahidi tells Time from Sheikh Redwan near Gaza City. Her husband eats 1, she eats half, so the child can eat 1.5 pieces a day. But their already meager supplies are dwindling. Taim goes to sleep hungry, she says. He still doesn't have enough milk. The ramifications could be long-lasting for Taim and the Gazans at large, with experts cautioning an entire generation could be permanently affected as a result of being deprived of enough food. According to data from the UN Relief and Works Agency, 1 in 5 children under the age of 5 in Gaza City is now malnourished. In May alone, more than 5,000 children were diagnosed with malnutrition, which over the long term could result in stunted growth, impaired cognitive development, and weakened immune systems. The impacts are particularly devastating during the first 3 years of life, when the central nervous system and brain are still forming, according to 0-3, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization. The consequences could also last into adulthood, especially for women who, when they experience chronic malnutrition early in life, face a higher risk of complications during pregnancy and childbirth. The risk is now acute, with up to 20% of Gaza's estimated 55,000 pregnant women facing malnourishment, according to the UN Population Fund. As Al-Wahidi told Time, the widespread lack of food means each day is a struggle. We do not feel that we have any energy at all, she says. We try to distract ourselves with anything to get the day over with. Here is the time off section, the franchise that fell to earth. This is by Judy Berman. Noah Hawley's Alien prequel series stars Sydney Chandler in a role anticipating Ripley's. Okay, I'm turning the page now. Maybe the article will start here. A spacecraft hurtling through the cosmos, an indomitable female lead, armed crew members creeping through claustrophobic hallways where death could be lurking around any corner, a hostile alien that looks like a giant bullet-headed scorpion in fetish gear and bleeds acid the color and consistency of infected snot. all that extraterrestrial drool. These are the hallmarks of the Alien franchise, which have remained mostly consistent across the seven movies, plus two vacuous Alien vs. Predator crossovers that have kept those terrifying xenomorphs coming back to our screens every decade since the original premiered in 1979. Yet Alien, by the way, Alien is always italicized, Alien has always been an elastic property. In 1986, James Cameron followed up Ridley Scott's minimal work of cosmic horror with Aliens, an action spectacle for a maximalist era. Hero Ellen Ripley's Sigourney Weaver, lonely fight for survival gave way to a military mission to vanquish aliens ravaging a human colony. Cameron filled the frame with cocky Marines, boxy space tanks, and an adorable orphan who finds in Ripley a surrogate mother. Both films rank among the best in their respective genre. Subsequent features have not been nearly as successful. In the 90s, David Fincher, Alien 3, and Amelie director Jean-Pierre Jeunet, Alien Resurrection, mishandled the intellectual property. Even Scott's intriguing but convoluted 2010's origin stories and 2024's adequate Alien Romulus, soon to be followed by a sequel, do little to dispel the impression that the franchise's heyday ended 39 years ago, especially in light of this history. FX's fantastic Alien Earth, the first live-action Alien series, is a remarkable achievement, but I would not call it a surprise. With ambitious small-screen takes on the Coen brothers' opus Fargo and the Marvel superhero Legion under his belt, the show's creator, Noah Hawley, has built a reputation on reinvigorating hard-to-adapt IP in series fueled by profound insight into what makes a decades-old story relevant now. In the case of Alien, the subjects of artificial intelligence and corporate overreach provide more than enough fodder for cerebral sci-fi horror grounded in the anxieties of 2025. Set in 2120, 2 years before Scott's Alien, Earth, opens with parallel storylines in space, the crew of the Maginot, whose name ominously references France's expensive but futile World War II Nazi defense, awakens from years of cryogenic slumber to return to Earth, their precious cargo to be delivered to the franchise's canonical evil megacorp, Weyland-Yutani, is a menagerie of novel life forms, including some familiar eggs. Of course, things go sideways. The creatures kill everyone except one cyborg. Meanwhile, on a terrestrial island called Neverland, trillionaire wunderkind cavalier Samuel Blinken is using a secret technology he developed to transfer the consciousness of terminally ill kids into synthetic, superhuman, theoretically immortal humanoid bodies. The first of these hybrids, our Ripley surrogate, christens herself Wendy. Imagine Wendy being on the island called Neverland, was it? The kids who come after her will be named for lost boys. These plots literally collide when the Maginot falls to Earth, crash landing in a city controlled by Cavalier's upstart company, Prodigy. Casualties aside, the accident has geopolitical as well as business implications. In the show's timeline, the world is ruled by a tenuous alliance of five massive companies, of which Yutani and Prodigy are two. Their rivalry in the race to immortality will decide the fate of the universe. A 22nd century disruptor in the mold of Uber, Prodigy is all in on hybrids. Yutani may be plundering the wildlife of far-off planets in hopes they possess the secret to eternal life. Hawley uses this setup to reestablish the atmosphere alien fans have come to expect. The tight corridors, the jump scare attacks, the gross creatures, even the alien drool. Aesthetics have always been crucial to the franchise. Cybergoth artist H.R. Giger was instrumental in designing the look of the original, including the xenomorph. Earth features similarly murky visuals and fearsome monsters, many original to the show. Yet after a riveting first half of the premiere, slow burn action and horror sequences all but arrest the development of the plot and characters until episode 3. But the fourth episode is a revelation, enthralling in its setup of a war between two psychopathic corporations that doubles as a battle for control of Earth. It's also rich with insight into the peculiar interiority of Wendy and the Lost Boys, who look like adults but see the world as kids, express emotions, but reside in robotic bodies physically and mentally enhanced beyond the capacity of any mortal. What makes them geniuses is the fact they're children, Cavalier theorizes, because children have access to a world of infinite imagination. Are they humans, robots, or both? As one Prodigy scientist frets, if we did this wrong, we got a bunch of AIs running around thinking they're human. Worst case, we killed 6 kids. From there, like a spaceship fleeing to its home solar system, Earth is firing on all cylinders. Narrative, stylistic, psychological, philosophical. Science fiction has one main question, Hawley argued in a recent interview, whether humanity deserves to survive. In all these stories of the first contact or going out into the universe and meeting species that are either smarter than us or more deadly than us, this dilemma consumes what might be the most influential sci-fi work of the current century, Chinese author Chicxin Liu's The Three-Body Problem, which Netflix adapted last year. Even the new Superman movie flirts with the idea that our fractious species might be improved by an infusion of alien seed into the gene pool. As the climate crisis escalates, as deaths keep mounting in Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, as authoritarianism trends, it's not hard to see why storytellers are framing the prospect of extraterrestrials annihilating or fundamentally altering humanity as a potentially positive outcome for the planet, if not the universe. In Earth, that questioning takes the form of Hawley's critique of hypercapitalism and ambivalence toward AI. The Five, as the ruling syndicate is called, exerts unchecked financial and legal power. When Wendy's human brother Hermit, Alex Lawther, a Prodigy employee, appeals to the company to release him from his contract so he can fulfill his dream of attending medical school, a synthetic arbitrator coldly rejects his request. Conceived before Donald Trump's return to Washington, but rife with resonance about Elon Musk's stint there, the scene illustrates the dehumanizing potential of AI-abetted corporate supremacy. What, you may ask, does all this have to do with aliens? Well, you can't spell alien without AI, and androids have always been part of the franchise. In Earth, the two are more linked than ever. Both are super intelligent, lethal, existential threats to humanity, for which humanity has no one to blame but itself. Neither would have posed a danger had greedy tech barons not released them from the Pandora's box of scientific progress. Some of the series' most subtly chilling scenes show aliens manipulating their captors with the ease of a person commanding a well-trained dog. So it makes sense that Wendy, once fixated on reuniting with Hermit, comes to identify with the specimens in the lab. By reframing aliens as a mirror of and metaphor for AI, while calling back to Alien's villain, a murderously self-interested Weyland-Yutani rep, Paul Reiser, Earth preserves the franchise's best tropes, but also expands its palette of ideas. Hawley has described his exploration of humanity and the terrible things that we do to each other as a form of moral horror. Let me rephrase that. As a form of moral horror, layered beneath the body horror or creature horror. The latter are still very much present, but it is the moral horror that makes Earth more than another goopy interplanetary melee. Hawley worked from a similar playbook with Legion, whose apparently schizophrenic superhero filtered a fast-evolving cultural conversation around mental illness through a psychedelic kaleidoscope, and especially Fargo, a quirky, darkly comedic crime anthology set, like the film, in a snowy Midwest. Fargo has cannily applied the Coens' good versus evil framework to discourse around such fraught topics as gender and race. Hawley places infinite trust in his audience's intelligence and patience. Occasionally, as in the obscurity of Legion's later episodes or the plodding pace of some Fargo plots, this approach can verge on self-indulgence, but mostly at a time when some streamers tailor their programs to avoid confusing viewers glued to their phones, it is refreshing to watch TV that treats you like an adult. Fargo's most haunting image comes at the very end of season 3, written around the time of the 2016 election. An avatar for good and an embodiment of evil sit face to face, locked in an eternal clash of wills. There's a sense to which this year's Fargo is really a mirror, reflecting our reality back to us at this moment in time, but we do not know how it's going to end, Hawley said when it aired. If that show suggests he's a moralist, one caught between optimism and pessimism about whether humanity will or should prevail, Alien Earth confirms it. And in this four-way staring contest that pits people against corporations, AI, and aliens, the permeable mammalian eye faces stiff competition, indeed. Time off reviews. The 100 Best Podcasts by Eliana Doctorman, Pop Culture, Fighting in the War Room. This podcast helps listeners decide how to spend their precious viewing time. Standing out from similar pods by living up to its name, the four hosts, longtime friends and critics, argue over the quality of shows and movies, and not in polite, soft NPR tones, as they challenge one another to justify contrarian takes. Society, the longest, shortest time. In its first run from 2010 to 2019, this podcast delved into essential topics like whether to get genetic testing before having a baby, and delivered twisty tales of parenting. Since relaunching this year, the show is newly focused on stories that reflect urgent issues, pertaining to the topic, like reproductive health, the technology changing how babies are made, how we talk to kids about sex, and more. True crime, the retrievals. This stunning piece of investigative journalism lays out the story of a Yale University fertility clinic nurse who siphoned off fentanyl from patients undergoing egg retrieval surgery, leaving them in unspeakable pain. When the women complained, they were dismissed. It is a horror story about how our healthcare system fails women, and a disturbing but eye-opening commentary on the quest to become pregnant. History, you were wrong about. Michael Hobbs and Sarah Marshall started this podcast to re-examine people and moments whose stories were either misreported by the media, misinterpreted by the public, or could simply benefit from a look through a modern lens. Think Tonya Harding, O.J. Simpson, Princess Diana. Episodes now hosted solo by Marshall offer new angles and revelations. At its best, the podcast dismantles a mistaken mainstream narrative to reveal a deeper societal truth. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.